The Triumph of the Holy Cross. Hello and welcome to this Lumen Verum apologetics lecture by Imogen Hitchings on the topic, The Triumph of the Holy Cross. This September 2007 recording comes from one of Lumen Verum's Friday evening apologetics lectures at St. Michael the Archangel Parish in Belfield.
Now, before I go any further, does anyone know anything about the title, The Triumph of the Holy Cross? Yeah? Have you heard of the name Constantine?
Yes.
Or Constantinople? See, this is going to come into it. So, the Emperor Constantine was the very last and the very first emperor, in the sense that he was the last pagan emperor and the first Christian emperor. He became baptized towards the end of his life. He didn't, somehow he believed in the Christian religion and in the force of it, but he actually didn't commit himself until he's almost close to his death that he became a Christian. Now, today is the Triumph of the Holy Cross, September 14th, 2007, and this feast was originally the Feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross, by which name it is still known by the Orthodox Church. Since 1970, it's been officially called the Triumph of the Cross by the Roman Catholic Church. It is also popularly known among Roman Catholics and Anglicans as Holy Cross Day. Have you heard of Holy Cross Day? No? In Jewish folklore, the feast was established by St. Peter for converted pagans to observe instead of Rosh Hashanah. Now, St. Helen was the mother of St. Constantine the Great. Now, Constantine's father was an emperor, so when he died, Constantine took his place. Now, by this time, the Roman Empire was divided into four. When Christ died on the cross, that was in the year 30 AD, we're talking about 300 years later. So we're talking here about the 4th century. We're going to go back. The Feast of the Holy Cross was instituted in result of something that happened in the 6th century, but I'm going to take you back 200 years to the 4th century because to explain what happened. Now, do you remember when you're making the Stations of the Cross, you come to, I think it's a night station where Jesus meets the women and they're weeping and crying, and 8th station, thank you, Stephen. They're crying for him and they suffer because to see him so cruelly treated. And he says, do not weep for yourself, daughters of Jerusalem, but for your children. Do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves. And he was foretelling of the destruction of Jerusalem that was going to occur in the year 40 AD, when the Romans were going to come in and they'll raise the whole of Jerusalem to the ground, including the wall that defended the city. Everything was just razed to the ground. The Temple of Solomon was totally destroyed, and as today there's still only one wall of the temple left. Now, that was the beginning of what I'm going to speak about here. Because the Romans came back in the year 41, the next year, and rebuilt Jerusalem. They rebuilt the wall. Now, if you remember, when Christ died on the cross on the hill of Calvary, it was outside the wall of Jerusalem. So when Jerusalem was razed to the ground, the wall went also. And when it was rebuilt, Calvary was actually inside the new wall. This is all very significant, because I'll tell you what happened later. Now, the Roman Emperor at the time decided to destroy all vestige or memory of the Christian religion. And he did this, he thought, by covering over places where the Christians had gone in pilgrimage, especially to Mount Calvary, where Jesus Christ had died. So he covered the whole area of that particular place with this huge temple to the goddess one of the Roman goddesses. She's got two names here, and I don't have any of either of them at the moment, but he covered it up with this Aphrodite, that's right, to the goddess Aphrodite. so that the Christians couldn't worship or couldn't come back to these holy places anymore. He did that to several of the holy places in Jerusalem. He just covered them over with temples to their pagan gods and goddesses. Now, when Constantine was crowned emperor of Rome, not Rome, of his part of the western part of the empire, it was done in York, in England. And there's a statue of him outside York Minster Cathedral.
Can you tell us the date?
Yes, I can.
The year.
He was proclaimed emperor in the year 306. So that's where the story starts. Now, Constantine could see that Christian religion was becoming more and more popular, bit by bit, and it was taking ground. And that was an interesting, he watched it. He was a very keen observer of what was going on around about him. He himself was not a Christian. However, he decided that having some of the kingdom or the empire was not enough for him. He had to conquer Rome, and Rome was under the patronage of another emperor called Maxentius. Now, Maxentius was a very cruel, wicked emperor who still persecuted the Christians with all his power and all his might. So Constantine prayed to the God of the Christians, and he asked the God of the Christians to show him a way whereby he could conquer this emperor Maxentius. And God didn't appear to him, but he showed him this sign. It's the sign we all are very familiar with. It's like a P and an X, and it's the first two letters of the Greek alphabet for the word Christ. Now, God also instructed Constantine to make sure all his soldiers had this mark on their shields and on the flags as they were in his battle. And Maxentius' army was a far superior army to Constantine's, outnumbered him. It was, if they had all the, you know, best weaponry, everything else, but Constantine defeated the army, and Maxentius ended his life in the river Tiber. Fell into the Tiber, he was badly wounded, died, and that part of the kingdom passed into Constantine's hands. Now, Constantine's mother, just to give you some background, was Helena. Helena came from, anyway, she came from another place. I've written it down, but I can't find it, so apologies. But her father was just an innkeeper. She was not a Christian. She was actually the mistress of Constantine's father, who had I don't know how many wives he had, but Helena was his mistress. So she lived really only for her son, Constantine. And between the two of them, Constantine then decided that he was going to do a few things. First of all, after his victorious battle, he set up a triumphal arch. This is just a little bit from his triumphal arch. He's there talking to his soldiers. That's Constantine there talking to his soldiers about his victory. And this arch, you can still see this today. It's just next to the Colosseum in Rome. It's a frieze. It's on the top right-hand corner. Some of it's been destroyed. And he's talking to his soldiers, addressing his men from the triumphal arch in Rome, built to commemorate his victory over Maxentius. Now, Constantine had a plan, which he didn't reveal entirely to the people of Rome, bit by bit. He decided that he was going to make Christianity the official religion of Rome, but he wasn't going to force it onto anyone. He abolished crucifixion. So I'll have a look at my dates and just have a look. In 306, he was proclaimed emperor by the West. In 312, on October 28th, he defeated Maxentius in Rome. He received a sign from God on the Milvian Bridge, just before they fought the battle at the Milvian Bridge. Then in 326, apparently after about 10 years of planning, with his mother and his officers, he sent his mother on a pilgrimage, the very first royal pilgrimage, so to speak, to Jerusalem, because he worked it out that he had to have something that was visible and something that was, you know, tangible to back up his plan. And what he wanted, he had a huge plan and a very big thinker, this man. He decided he was going to go back and send his mother back to find the relics of the true cross. He knew the true cross must be buried somewhere in Jerusalem. and he was going to find it and bring it back to Rome. And he was going to make the cross the center of his plan. So he abolished crucifixion straight away. His mother took 3 years. She made this huge pilgrimage. She went from Rome to Constantinople, from Constantinople to Antioch, from Antioch to Caesarea, and from Caesarea to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. And she apparently was shown also in a vision where to find Christ's cross. Now, Christ's cross was buried under the temple to Aphrodite. The whole of Calvary Hill was buried under the temple to Aphrodite. So she had already arranged with her son that when she discovered where the place was, if it was covered by a building, she had permission to raise it to the ground. So she did that. She had the whole building raised to the ground, and then they started digging, and she found, deep down, she found the cave. Actually, even Joseph of Arimathea's tomb was and is still under there. So she found the cave where she found the three crosses, Christ's cross and the two from the two prisoners on either side of him, his nails that nailed him to the cross, his crown of thorns, the sponge of hyssop that was given to him, so the vinegar and the lance, all found in the same place, covered with a load of rubbish underneath this this particular temple. So it was their plan, mother and son, to build a Catholic church on the top, which they did, as soon as they recovered all these things. And also in underneath that place, other people obviously had found that this is before the temple was built. Christian pilgrims had travelled to this place and drawn graffiti, you know, really good graffiti. For instance, they'd drawn the boat, a special boat they had travelled on to see this, and the boat, of course, is a sign of the church. And it was from that time. So they had written Dominus beside the boat, and they'd written all kinds of things. So they had discovered this place before Helena did. Anyway, she had the help of the patriarch at the time of Jerusalem, who helped her. Now, they had to work out which of these three crosses was a cross that Christ was crucified on. So the patriarch knew of this woman who was dying, and she had about two days to live. And they brought the crosses one by one to her, and when they brought our Lord's cross, of course, she was cured instantly. It didn't even touch her. It got within a couple of feet of her, and she just, you know, was totally healed on the spot. So that's how they identified the cross of Christ. Then Helena, what she did was she divided the cross into three pieces, also the headboard, you know, that was ordered by Pontius Pilate. About that long. And they split that up into three pieces. The cross is split into some parts. They left the majority of the cross in Jerusalem, and she had a silver reliquary, I think, made for it. I don't know how big it would have been, but with the remnants of the cross pieces inside that silver reliquary. And that was to remain in Jerusalem. She sent some to her son, Constantine, and she took some back to Rome, where she lived. Now, you must remember that Helena at this time was 80 years old. By the time she finished all her investigations and ordered the rebuilding of the church on top of the Calvary site, she would have been about 83. And she had said, now some part of the headboard is still there in the church of Santa Croce. The church of Santa Croce in Rome was built onto her palace. And when you go there today, you can see it's two different styles of architecture. The frontispiece of the church is a much later model than the back. So that's where she lived. And she took those relics back as a personal, her own personal relics. And that part of the headboard, I think, is the only part that survives today. Now, the cross of Jerusalem that she left there remained undisturbed for 7 centuries. Everything was set up, it was all beautiful and nice. And it remained there for 7 centuries until the Persians decided to come in and interfere and rob the place. So in the year 627, the Persian king came in, and he was a horrible man. I'm going to read you what he actually did. And apparently it took, by this time, this is another 300 years later, Constantine and his mother had died by now, but in 637 the Persians invaded, and it took the next Roman emperor, who was Heraclius, the first of Constantinople, he was actually an African. And he'd been asked to take the place of emperor, which he reluctantly took. But he was just the man God had chosen to defeat the Persians. And the Persians held on to the cross for 14 years. They sacked Jerusalem completely, took all, not just the treasures from the church, but from other places as well, back to Persia. Now, I'm just going to talk to you just about...
You are listening to Imogen Hitchings discussing the triumph of the Holy Cross for Lumen Verum Apologetics on cradio.org.au.
Now, I'm just going to talk to you just about that for a minute. The name of the man, the Persian emperor at the time, was Sarbasara. He was the one who took the cross back to Jerusalem. But before they took back things to Jerusalem, to Persia, they did a good job of sacking the place. What they did was, I'm just trying to find it, I had it here. Here we are. This man, Khosrows II, C-H-O-S, the most barbarous and perfidious king of Persia, broke peace with the empire, availing himself of the weakness of the reign of the cruel and covetous usurper Phocas, broke peace with the empire upon the pretense of revenging the murder of the emperor Mauritius and his family, whom Phocas, this is internal warfare, right, had massacred. They just massacred each other. They didn't just kill a man who was in power and kill his wife and all his children and all his concubines. They all went, you know, the whole lot. So there's no one to take their place. Anyway, the Persians, meeting opposition, plundered Mesopotamian part of Syria. Then they went to they almost made it to Constantinople, but they didn't make it there. But they sacked other places, bit by bit, Caesarea, Cappadocia. They took about 5 years before they got to Jerusalem, and in the meantime they destroyed Antioch, Edessa, Apamea, Caesarea, Cappadocia, Damascus, and then Jerusalem. They took over Jerusalem.
What year would have
that been? I haven't got the years. I just got it. By the time they got to 627, so that's what? They took 5 years before 627, worked that out. All right, and by the time they got to Jerusalem in 627. So this is what they did with Jerusalem. In the month of June, they possessed themselves of Jerusalem, filling that city with outrages which cannot be mentioned without horror. Many thousands of clerks, monks, nuns, and virgins were cruelly massacred. 90,000 Christians were sold for slaves to the Jews. And afterwards, many of them were tortured and slain. The churches, even that of the Holy Sepulchre, were burned. That's a church that Constantine had built. And all the rich removables were carried away, among which were an infinite number of consecrated vessels, many precious relics, and that part of the wood of the true cross, which had been left there by St. Helena. The patrician Narcissus found means, by the help of one of the friends of Sarbasara, the Persian general, to save two holy relics. So he managed to save the sponge and the lance, both of which he sent to Constantinople. The sacred sponge was exposed to the view of the people, etc., on the Feast of the Exaltation of the Holy Cross on the 14th September the same year. Now, the patriarch Zachary was carried away captive into Persia with a great multitude of other persons. Now, these losses and calamities forced Heraclius again subsequently to beg peace of the victorious tyrant, who laughed at his request and blasphemously declared that he would never let those men rest so long as they should adore one who had been crucified by other men and should refuse to worship the sun god. They thought, these men deserve to be captured, deserve to be robbed, deserve to be ill-treated because they didn't worship the sun god. Goodness gracious, every man alive worshiped the sun god. Any man worthy of the name man worshiped the sun god. Why would they worship an idiot who was crucified on the cross? That's a loser. You don't worship a loser, you worship someone who's worth worshiping. So this was his excuse to ill-treat people. Heraclius, however, depending wholly upon the Saviour of the world, whose glory he was to assert in the extreme poverty of the state, he, poor man, he had borrowed gold and silver, which was found in churches, and coined it into money to raise an army for the protection of his subjects. Now, a lot went on, and the Persians were still succeeding. They were invading and pillaging and, you know, having their own way and having a wonderful time. So the emperor resolved that they had to carry the war into Persia itself. To oblige the infidels to return home for the defence of their own country, that he might not leave any enemies behind him, he concluded a peace with the Chan of the Turchi Abari, who had attacked him in the side of Thrace. And in the year 622, the 12th year of his reign, began his march towards Persia immediately after Easter. He prayed to God to give him strength to defeat this enemy. And he went with a miraculous picture of Jesus Christ in his hands, and he held it up in front of his army. He protested to his soldiers that he would never abandon them till death, and set before them how the enemies of God had overrun their country, rendered the cities desolate, laid the country to waste before them, burnt the sanctuaries, profaned the holy altars with blood, defiled the sanctity of the most holy places by their brutal lusts and debaucheries. With his army, he defeated the Persians the same year in Armenia, and in the ensuing summer, he took the city Gazak in Persia and burnt in it the fine temple and the palace of Chosroes, in which was a rich statue of that prince sitting under a dome. He considered himself a god, which represented the heavens, the sun, moon, and stars, and around it angels holding scepters in their hands with wind chimes to make a noise like thunder, because he was the god of Persia, you know. He'd really up himself, his man. Leading his army back to take winter quarters in Albania, he there, out of compassion, this is going back to Heraclius, he had released 50,000 Persian captives he had brought with him and supplied them with necessaries. An act of humanity made them all pray with tears for his success, that he might deliver Persia from a tyrant who by his cruelty and his actions was a destroyer of mankind. The emperor's campaigns in 624 and 625 were still more successful against numberless armies of the enemy. Cyberazza, the Persian general, arrived with a strong army before Chalcedon and was seconded by the perfidious Chan of the Avari, who had signed, you know, agreements with him earlier, broke their truce, attacked Constantinople on the European side of the Straits. They were, however, both repulsed by the Christians in July 626, and in their disorder, they slew one another. So God did something to them where they didn't even recognize each other. They killed each other, not the enemy, which is wonderful. This deliverance was looked upon as miraculous, obtained by the intercession of the Blessed Virgin, as the Paschal Chronicle, Theophanes, and particularly Sidranus relate. Then, now, this is amazing. How he actually defeated the Persians was through their family. God did this to satisfy his wrath, I think, at the way these people had treated his cross. On the 12th of December in 627, Heraclius gave the Persians an entire overthrow almost without any loss on his side, near the ruins of the ancient city of Nineveh, under the command of Resestes, who was himself found among the slain, the shield and armor of messy gold. With him fell most of the field officers and the greatest part of the Persian army. The proud Chosroes was driven from town to town, yet continued obstinately deaf to all proposals of peace. Heraclius, in his pursuit, burnt down all the king's houses of pleasure, but often released prisoners without a ransom, though the barbarian detained even his ambassadors. The disdain with which Chosroes rejected all means of peace, even though Heraclius was master of the greatest part of Persia by his time, extremely exasperated his subjects. That is, Chosroes, who was the enemy, who was really defeated but wouldn't admit defeat, his subjects were fed up with him, because they wanted to end this devastation, and they wanted him to end it, but he wouldn't end it because he wouldn't claim defeat. So, what happened was, his general Cyberazza, who was near Chalcedon, upon information that his master had condemned him to die, openly revolted from him to the Romans. So, Cyberazza went on to the Roman side. Chosroes locked himself up with his wives and children in the strong city of Seleucia on the Tigris, and there, being seized with dysentery, declared Marsanes, or Marsas, his son by Cyrene, the most beloved of his concubines, his successor, and ordered preparations to be made for his coronation. He's a man who's so proud he wouldn't give in. Now, his eldest son, who had been looked over for the emperorship, provoked at this injustice, appealed to the nobles, took up arms, released the Roman prisoners whom he sent back to Heraclius, seized on his father, bound him in chains, threw him into a strong dungeon, which Chosroa had himself fortified to keep his treasures in. Exasperated more and more over his father's arrogance, even though the tyrant saw himself in his power, Cyrus set no bounds to his rage, allowing only a small quantity of bread and water for his subsistence, and bade him eat the gold which he had amassed by the oppression of so many innocent people. He sent his satraps and his enemies to insult him, and caused Marizanes, that's the other son, whom he would have crowned, and all the rest of his children to be murdered before his eyes. In this manner was the old king treated for 5 days together, during which time he was frequently shot at and wounded with arrows, but not mortally, so that his death might be the more lingering. He expired on the 5th day of his wounds. Thus, by God's judgment, perished Chosroes II by the hands of an unnatural son, having himself mounted the throne by imbruing his hands in the blood of his father, Hormisdas. So Chosroes had killed his own father to get the position he was in, and then he was killed by his own son. Divine justice. And filled not only his kingdom but all the east with murders and desolation during a reign of 35 years. Cyrus concluded a firm peace with Heraclius, released all the Roman prisoners, and among the rest, Zachary, patriarch of Jerusalem, restored the provinces which the Christians had lost, and among other spoils, the true cross, which had been carried to Persia 14 years before by Sabaratza when he took Jerusalem. Now, that's not the end of that story. It has a beautiful ending, of which this feast commemorates, today's feast. They got back to Jerusalem. They took everything back, most of the things that they could get that belonged to them, they took back, especially the Holy Cross. So, when they came back, he first went to the emperor to Constantinople, where he made his entry with the most splendid triumph. And then in the beginning of spring the following year, in 629, he embarked to carry the cross again to Jerusalem and return thanks to God in that holy place for his victories. He would carry it upon his shoulders into the city with the utmost pomp. Suddenly, at the entrance to the city, he couldn't move. It was as if that cross, it was only, a third of it, was bearing down on him. It was like it was sort of pinning him to the ground. He couldn't move. So Zachary looked at him and he said, "Sire, you're wearing all the pomp of your emperorship. When Christ carried that cross, he carried it as a poor man, barefooted with hardly any clothes on him." So the emperor took off his crown and his robes and his gold shoes, and he walked in and he wore the garb of a poor man or a pilgrim, poor pilgrim. And then he was able to carry the cross back into Jerusalem, into the city. So our Lord, our God, crowned this event with many, many miracles. As he carried the cross, still in its silver case, the patriarch and the clergy, finding the seals whole, opened the case with the key, venerated it, and showed it to the people. The original writers speak always of this portion of the cross in the plural number, calling it the pieces of the wood of the cross, which shows that it consisted of different pieces. This solemnity was performed with the most devout thanksgiving and honored with miraculous cures of several sick persons. The ceremony of exposing this sacred relic is the most lively memorial of the sufferings of a divine redeemer to the veneration of the faithful on this and several other days is very solemn, and is often mentioned both before and after the recovery of this part of the cross from the infidels. Apparently, there were not only cures of the ill, but many possessed people. The demons came out of many, many possessed people, and lame could walk. It was just amazing. People just got healed instantly. So that is really the feast we're supposed to be celebrating today. But the other feast of the finding of the true cross by Helena is usually celebrated in May, and different Orthodox churches celebrate them different times, and there's different emphases. Different Orthodox people have different ways of celebrating the triumph of the Holy Cross. In England it's known as something else. So basically, the chief priest that took up the cross. Now, about 7 days before the 1st August, the Holy Cross, that is a large portion which Constantine the Great deposited in Constantinople, was taken out of the Holy Treasury, in which it was kept other relics and rich holy vessels between the 3rd and 6th Ode of Matins. It was laid on the ground that the chief priest of the palace might anoint it all over with balm and precious perfumes. Then it was set up in the church of the palace of Our Lady of the Pharaohs, or opposite to the Pharaohs, exposed to the veneration of the people. This is at Constantinople. After matins, the clergy of the palace assembled before it, singing hymns in praise of the cross, called Stavosima, or of the cross. Then the princes and the lords came to venerate it before they assisted at the Sunday procession, in which they attended the emperor not every Sunday and holy day to the divine service in the church of the palace or on certain great festivals to some other principal church. So they carried the cross from the main church after Mass to all the main churches in Constantinople, and all the nobility, followed by all the people, venerating the Holy Cross right around. The chief priest then took up the cross on his head, having on a purple cassock and over it a rich scalamangium, or a great cope which covers the whole body, and attended by the clergy and others in procession, carried it through the golden hall before the oratory of St. Basil, placed it to be venerated by all the senate, then proceeded to the palace of Daphne, and exposed it in the church of St. Stephen. And on the 28th of July, the priests began to carry the cross through all the streets, into all the houses and outlets around the walls of the city, by the devotion of the people and their united prayers, God would, through the cross and merits of his Son, praying to God. So the Holy Cross, until Constantine got rid of the practice of crucifixion, then people started to make facsimile editions of the cross. And until that time, there were no crosses in our churches, not one, not a single cross. Constantine still forbade the figure of Christ to be on the cross. He didn't like that. So the figure of Christ wasn't placed on the cross until some many years later, I'm not sure when. But in his time, he forbade it because he thought it was an insult. He didn't like it. So Constantine himself did a lot. He and Helena brought the cross as the most significant, important symbol this world has ever known, and placed it where it should have been placed from the beginning. So we have these two to thank. They made who made a routine execution. People were used to these executions. They made it the central figure of our redemption. If it hadn't been for his insight and his strength of character, Constantine and Helena would never ever have achieved. We would never have the cross, or we don't know how long it would have taken to. But God, of course, inspired them and helped them. So I think that's the end of this talk. Basically, I try to keep it as short as I possibly could, because it tends to get a bit, if you go into all the details, it tends to get a little bit, you get a bit lost. I'm thinking about, you look a bit lost. That's why some of you sitting there look a bit lost. But just keep the memory of Constantine and Helena in the 4th century, and Heraclius and the Persians in the 7th century. So, but it's sad in the sense that that cross that was rescued from the Persians and brought back was then finally lost in the Crusades in the 12th century. The Crusaders started taking that cross out every time they fought the Turks, or the Muslims as we know them. They won most of the battles until the 12th century, when they lost the one with Saladin, and the cross also was lost. The Muslims set fire to the field. There had no rain that year, there's a great drought, and they set fire to the fields between the marching army of the Christians on horseback and the Muslims on this side, and they lost a lot of them, fell into the fires and were burned, and the cross was burnt in the fires. So even after all that stress and tribulation and many, many lives lost to rescue the cross, it was lost. But thank goodness that Helena had dispatched two more sections across to Constantinople and to Rome, so that pieces and bits of it have been spread right around the world. In different reliquaries, priests have some, different people have just segments of the Holy Cross. So it is, I suppose, Christ will probably gather his cross to himself at the end of the world. I wonder whether he will. You know, but it's still there, and so we now have the privilege and the responsibility to promote devotion to the Holy Cross. And it's in our hands now, so this is a great, great feast day. And tomorrow, of course, the Feast of the Holy, the Seven Sorrows of Our Lady.
You have been listening to a Lumen Verum Apologetics lecture by Imogen Hitchings. For more Lumen Verum Apologetics lectures, visit cradio.org.au.